If you're going to walk, then I'm going to run right over you because I got nothing to lose. That's Winona Fighter. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Rough start to this show aside. Great weekend for the Toronto Blue Jays. They sweep the St. Louis Cardinals. They went 4-3 in 11 innings on Friday. Good one from Kevin Gausman after Yenesis Cabrera blew the lead in the eighth. The offense comes through. Alejandro Kirk with a walk-off single. George Springer stole base. Vlad had a double. Saturday rolls around. Much easier. 7-2 victory. Jose Berríos is excellent. Davis Schneider has a breakout game, hits a home run, has three hits overall. Addison Barger and Nathan Lucas have good games. Alejandro Kirk comes up with a couple more big RBI. It's good stuff. And then Sunday rolls around, they win 3-2. Yariel Rodriguez goes 4 1/3, only gives up one run. So that's a couple of good ones in a row here for Yariel as he looks to close his season strong. Davis Schneider has another good game, homers again. Nathan Lucas has a pair of doubles. You look at the whole weekend. They sweep the Cardinals. They continue to get really good pitching from their starters who went a combined 18 1/3 innings with just 4 earned runs allowed, so an ERA just below 2. If you look back at the last couple times through the rotation, the Jays have been doing this pretty well. The offense has been quietly over the last 45 days or so, one of the best in baseball. Now, that's some of that is a little bit, the weirdness and randomness and flow of late in the season and things like that, but also a lot of guys having good closes to their season, making good early cases. Nice to see Davis Schneider in particular coming around with a stronger weekend there. He obviously had a big hit early last weekend, and you'd hope that he could build off of that and kind of shake off some of the tough stretch that he's had this season. It does look like he was able to do that. Vlad, by the way, in addition to two hits and an unintentional walk in the weekend, got intentionally walked three times in this series. So even though he's fallen a little bit back of Bobby Wood Jr. here in the batting title race and would need a torrid final 2 weeks to catch up, he is getting walked a boatload, including intentionally. Nathan Lucas had five hits over the weekend. Davis Schneider also had five hits. So yeah, good to see some guys chipping in, some guys contributing. Nathan Lucas, who would have been with this team a lot more this year had he not been injured during a time when the Blue Jays needed call-ups and were juggling the roster and things like that. A guy who, certainly not a prospect at age 30, but I don't think I'm alone in thinking he's probably, a fourth or fifth outfielder somewhere in Major League Baseball next year, given everything he's shown at the AAA level and when given a chance in the Major League level. That doesn't change the outcome of your franchise, but it's nice to have those guys and find those guys inexpensively. Elsewhere in the system, Bo Bichette continues rehab Friday and Saturday. Sounds like he'll rejoin the team in Texas tomorrow. Sadly, the Vancouver Canadiens lost in the Northwest League Championship. They lost an extra inning game on Saturday to drop that series 3-1. But good for them, a third consecutive season making the finals in that league. We'll wrap that up proper over the course of the week. The AA season ended on the weekend as well. So now it's just the Buffalo Bisons. They've got 6 games left. That's all that's left for the minor league system, other than Arizona Fall League, who we mentioned some of the names last week. Probably we'll get into it at some point later this week as well. Let's check in on the weekend that was with a guy whose voice I heard a lot of because he was doing color commentary on the radio for the series. It's Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters. Ben, how we doing, buddy?
Blake, doing great. It was a fun weekend. Rare sweep from the Jays and some nice weather at the Dome. So, it was a good time and hope you're doing well, too.
Yeah, I'm good. I was home with the nephews all weekend, so I am a little exhausted. I don't know how people with kids do it full time. I go in and I get my 6 hours of, okay, I'm wrestling two kids for the whole weekend, and then I'm toast after with you and Ben Schulman on the radio in the background. How were the calls? How'd you enjoy it?
Great time. Yeah. There was some pretty close baseball. I mean, obviously the extra innings on Friday. Saturday was pretty close for the most part until the Jays were able to create some separation late. And then Sunday was another good one. So anytime I'm in that situation, I know you've done those games as well. And I think that it's so much better when every play matters and when every decision matters. Then, of course, we understand that in the course of this season, the Jays are not making the playoffs. We all get that. But if there's a little tension in the game itself, I think that lends itself to a better game. And we had a few of those. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Would it be fair to characterize this as, when we're talking on the show today, we don't necessarily care about the use of Luis Frias on Saturday. But when you're actually in the game, you are still locked in and you care who's coming in and the matchups and why a certain guy is being used, even if big picture, what comes of that is probably not crazy relevant.
Yeah, exactly. And I think like even pitch selection, right? Like I highly doubt that you and I are going to spend any time today talking about the pitch selection from anyone over the weekend. But when you're watching those games and someone throws three sliders in a row or they can't locate their fastball for a period of 10 pitches, then that is significant. And I just think it's, you know, you stay present in that moment with the game. You watch exactly what's happening. You look at what's happening in the bullpen. Maybe there's something, you know, weird or different happening in the stands or in the dugout. And it's, yeah, it's entertaining for me. So it was a really good time.
And it's a reminder that while the front office picked a direction at the trade deadline, the team operates these games like you're talking about. Every micro decision is still being analyzed. They're trying to get looks at guys. Guys are auditioning for jobs and things like that. So yeah, pretty important weekend. Also pretty important stretch of time here for us fantasy players. You got your championship locked up, even though we got 2 weeks left here? You can pat yourself on the back. It's okay. I know you declined to last week.
There's nothing to celebrate until the season's over. That's for sure. But I hear you're doing pretty well in your league. So that's encouraging.
Yeah. Huge break with Eno Saris getting knocked off in the semifinals, which gives me a better path to, better path to the potential championship here. Fingers crossed. Okay. So the Jays sweep, when you look at where things are heading into, you know, wrapping up 2024, heading into 2025, how encouraging is it for you when you look at, hey, Kevin Gausman's pitched pretty well the last couple starts. Jose Berríos looks pretty good the last couple starts. Yariel and Bowden are obviously their own thing, but it does look, at least on a results basis, that some of this extra rest for their veteran guys without having to have shut them down has done them well, because these guys have looked a little bit better the last couple times through the order than maybe they have all season.
Yeah, I would zone in on Gausman specifically there, because for Berríos, it's been maybe 8 or 9 starts. And this is, we've seen this from Berríos. He'll get cold, he'll get out of whack a bit, and then he'll find his rhythm. And now he's in a great rhythm and he's pitching well. And that's what we expect from Jose Berríos, who's having a really good year. But with Gausman, just given his age, I think there's a little bit more of a sense of, we've got to watch carefully and just a little bit less certainty moving forward. So especially the way he started the season. But when you watched him yesterday finishing off the sixth inning by throwing 98 and 99 mile an hour fastballs for a strikeout, I mean, that to me was pretty significant. And even if it hadn't ended in a strikeout, even if it had been a ground ball or a double off the wall for that matter, he's reaching back in the sixth inning of the 6 months of this season and he's finding 98, 99. And that was encouraging not only to onlookers like you and me, but for the Blue Jays. John Schneider noticed that as well, of course. And he was kind of impressed and thinking that, hey, this is actually, you know, mechanically, they really like the way Gausman was throwing on Friday night. And they want to see him in those mechanics more often. They want to see him hitting that 99 more often. And they would love to see that, I'm sure, next year when they're playing games that count early in the season. So it's easier said than done. 99 is really tough to access for any starting pitcher. But even for Kevin Gausman to do that one or two times, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, yeah. The takeaway of he should just throw 99 more is not particularly applicable, but it's good that he can get into it. And I've never really been a big believer in the, like, oh, there are multiple fastballs there. You know, he can reach back and dial a little more on it. The results are just so extreme that his harder fastballs are perform way, way better than his less hard fastballs. Like it's pretty straightforward. If you're pitching 200 innings, you got to be worried about your arm and stuff like this, but a good sign that he's pitching like this late into the year, from a fatigue and physicality standpoint. Ben, this is not necessarily about Kevin Gausman. This is more about you, but Kevin Gausman is sitting there with a 4.02 ERA. How badly would you personally be focused on got to get that below 4? Got it. Like it's right there. And Bassett's is only 420 too. So Bassett's a little further up, but like how fixated on that number would you be personally?
I personally would be quite fixated on it, and I would want it. I would very badly want it to be 3.99 or 3.98. It would, when you're that close, man, like, it kind of reminds me of Mark Burley. This is like 8 or 9 years ago, right? When they wanted to get him to 200 innings. Like sometimes those round numbers, like there is a significance to them. Like even someone who finishes the season with like 99 RBI, didn't Vladdy do that a year or two ago where he was like 97, 98 RBI? Like there's something to be said for these round numbers. And I am a numbers guy. So that is a That's a very apt question. And I personally, yes, I would want that to be 399 for sure.
Yeah, Vlad had 97 RBI in 2022. In addition to 32 home runs. And this year, like right now, Vlad is sitting like right on the edge of could he go 300, 30, 100. The 300 looks pretty safe. He's hitting 319 right now. He's at 28 home runs and 96 RBI. So he needs two homers and four RBI over these last 12 games to get there. I think you pretty comfortably get there. But you're not in super control of your RBI, right? Especially when you get intentionally walked three times in one weekend.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I'm actually sort of surprised. Ben Shulman and I were talking about this on the air over the weekend. I'm sort of surprised it hasn't happened more, because you look at the, you know, protection, using that word loosely, around Vlad Guerrero Jr., there's not much of it. And he's been so hot. It is kind of surprising that more teams haven't taken this approach and haven't walked him, even with the bases empty, like we saw with Devers against Gerrit Cole in the Bronx this weekend, right? Which, you know, that was a whole interesting little decision right there that didn't really work for the Yankees that day. But yeah, I think that this is something that Vlad Guerrero Jr. is going to have to face a lot more of. And that'll nudge the OBP forward, but it also means that the other guys in this lineup have to produce.
Yeah, it does. And it also means you can't knock a run in if you're getting intentionally wild. I guess technically you could do it if the bases were loaded, but that would have to be quite an extreme situation for that to happen. Man, the Burley one, can't believe you brought that up. What a way to, I guess I brought it up by looking at round numbers at the end of the season. But I remember I blogged like for my own just like personal blog about that, because I was like between jobs at the time and just gut wrenching. I wanted it so badly for him, and the defense just like failed him behind. Tough one for Mark Burley. That's 2015. Okay, more about the weekend. Yariel looked pretty good yesterday as well. 4 1/3 innings, one earned run. Kind of what we've come to expect, where the first sign of decline or trouble, they get him out of there because they're looking at the innings load and stuff like that. He's put together statistically three good starts in a row. I don't think the 1-2 start, like the 1-3 starts ago where he went three shutout innings but didn't look particularly good and the pitch count got up quick. That wasn't, you know, great to allow zero runs, but it wasn't super great. The last two, though, have been pretty solid. What have you seen from Yariel yesterday and over the last little bit to try to close strong here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly throwing strikes, attacking the hitters over the weekend, that's what they need to see. You don't want to see him walking guys. And he was, for the most part, in attack mode, of course, mixing up the fastball, mixing up the off speed, and even his delivery. I mean, I really appreciate the way that Rodriguez will mess with hitters' timings in some deliveries. A stark contrast to Miles Michaelis, who is very much straight to the plate. But I think with Yariel Rodriguez, you're getting signs of what it would look like as a major league starting pitcher. Here he is working in the sixth month of this season. That in itself is different than what he did last year, what he did as a reliever when he was in Japan. So he's testing himself in new ways and for the most part looking pretty solid. This is clearly a major league pitcher, and you know, he's now up to 98 innings on the season. So he'll pass 100, and that sets up, I mean, could it be 130, 140 next year? I mean, that seems like a pretty reasonable threshold if he's effective enough to warrant that many reps.
Yeah, and he's thrown 130 before in his career, but you have to go back to 2018 to the Cuban Winter Series for the last time he did that, because, again, in addition to not pitching in actual games last year, obviously he was throwing, but not pitching in competitive games, he was a reliever and a swingman for 3 years prior to that as well. Okay, so as we look at the last little bit here, Ben, off day today, another off day next Thursday. They had the off day this past Thursday. There is enough built-in rest there that there's only one day on the schedule where they would need a sixth starter or bullpen day, and even then could still have everyone on additional rest. How do you see them playing out these last 12?
Yeah, I think they might add in one more starter. Whether it's a Yarbrough, whether it's even a Jake Bloss, I don't think it would be more than that, because you don't really need to. But we're so close to the end now. I mean, they might have that answer for us tomorrow in Texas, because they really don't have to create that much more rest. For the most part, you're looking at two starts each for the starting pitchers in this rotation, and then you're good to go. So, you know, that would be 32 for Jose Berríos for the sixth straight year. Gausman, Bassett, they would have the chance to finish strong as well and complete seasons. But I think probably one more day just to err on the side of caution makes sense. And maybe that's Yarbrough, or if they wanted to, they could toss in Jake Bloss for one start.
Jake Bloss, who pitched yesterday for AAA Buffalo on regular rest. It went not tremendous, but a little better than some of his recent outings. So, yeah, he would be lined up for Saturday or Sunday. Or I guess, yeah, you could even go Friday if you really wanted to push it. But, yeah, so potentially Bloss on the weekend, which would be fun to see, even if his performance hasn't, like, screamed about it at the AAA level so far. Okay, so elsewhere from this weekend, on the offensive side, you know, I mentioned the Vlad intentional walks. Big weekend for Davis Schneider, who had five hits, including a pair of home runs. You're around this team all the time. You know what Davis Schneider means to that team, even when he's not playing particularly well. Are you a believer that, like, you know, he had the big hit earlier last week and then he has a good weekend like this, that a guy can kind of turn the page with just a small sample of meaningful success like that?
I think I'm sure it helps mentally, right? Because it had been since June 22nd that he had hit a home run, almost 3 months. That's a long time in the course of a 6-month major league season to go half that period of time without going deep. But he made some great contact this weekend. You see it there to the opposite field. Then he tapped into the pull power later in the series, and he looked really good. I mean, this looked like the kind of series that the Blue Jays hoped that they would be getting from Davis Schneider, you know, not every series, but every week or every couple of weeks, to have this kind of contribution. Certainly the way he finished last year, he showed he had that potential, but then he struggled so much against fastballs this season to the point where, you know, he really was not producing and really not deserving of a lot of playing time, which is why he was out of the starting lineup for so much of that time. So as for what it means going forward, the Jays still have a need for a right-handed hitter and someone who can be a complement to your Loperfitos, your Bargers, the Spencer Horwitzes of the world. So that need exists. Can Davis Schneider fill it? I don't know. I still don't know. And, you know, after this weekend, it nudges things forward. But in baseball, as you know better than most, Blake, you can't get too swept up with just what's happened in the last few days. And so I don't want to forget what happened for the last 3 months.
Yeah, and if we look at last year and this year combined, he's now at 159 games. So almost, you know, basically a season's worth of data. And he's been a little bit above average at the plate overall, but a little bit above average coming from where he came from, given how hot last year was. It's a pretty big decline. It would be great to see him, though, over these last 2 weeks, you know, build on that. And even if you wouldn't care about the overall numbers at the end, to show a little bit of, I figured it out, I can respond to what pitchers are doing to me or whatever was ailing me. And it seemed like from conversations with Matt Hague and John Schneider and Davis Schneider that he wasn't that far off. Like, in between was the term that Joe Siddle used a lot. Like, he was just, it wasn't something that was like very wrong mechanically or something he couldn't do. It was just like a little off. So maybe he can build on that. But yeah, I think probably best case scenario for him, he's coming into camp next year competing for a bench role, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I cannot foresee a world where he has a path to a full starting job. I mean, that's pretty clear. And then it's also hard to imagine a world where he doesn't have any chance of making the roster at all. So that kind of leaves him in the territory of, you got to earn it, and the opportunity, at least to begin, would probably be in a part-time role where you're facing a few righties, but probably a lot of lefties, trying to give those existing lefties on the Blue Jays roster, you know, day off or a partial day off. So that's where things are at, and I still think the Jays this offseason, they probably have to take a look at the right-handed hitters out there to see if there is a way to get some more certainty. The more risk you have, the more uncertainty you have, you know, that opens up the possibility for long slumps like we've seen. And, you know, that 3-month slump, I'm not saying that would happen again, but if Davis Schneider starts the season over April, that could be pretty costly for a team that is probably going to be in a really close playoff race. So it's not to write him off. He had a great weekend, and full credit to him for that. But what I'm saying here is he should have to earn the playing time that he gets going forward.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a weird case where, you know, he's one of the first hitters that I can remember who actually benefited from being right-handed instead of left-handed, because if he was another lefty, you know, he's probably optioned at this point, right? With how many other left-handed bench guys they've been trying to get looks here. So that'll help him come spring training time. But yeah, in terms of an everyday role, they're going to have to aim much, much higher at left field or third base or DH or multiple of those positions. And then the flip side of that is a guy like Nathan Lucas, who, if he wasn't left-handed, would have been on the roster a lot this year probably, and then obviously suffered an injury. I know it's a small window here, but given that Lucas is like 30 years old, has been an excellent two-way player at AAA for multiple years, has looked good when he's called up, it's maybe not with the Jays because of Loperfido and Varsho's left-handed and Will Wagner and Addison Barger around. But would you be confident that Nathan Lucas is a fourth or fifth outfielder in the major leagues for someone next year?
Yeah, I think so. I think so for sure. I mean, he showed yesterday those two doubles, both to the opposite field, some really big moments there for Nathan Lucas, including driving in George Springer for the winning run of the game. That's big contributions in big moments. And he hasn't had the luxury of struggling for 3 months in the major leagues. I mean, he has had to come up and produce right away, and he's done it. So I think that, you know, if he wasn't performing, you might look at his spot on the 40-man roster and his age, and you might say, this is a guy that you could cut over the offseason. The way things look right now, I wouldn't be in a rush to do that. I think that if you keep him on the 40-man roster over the winter and take him into spring training, you see what happens, right? Because there might be an injury to somebody. There might be a poor performance. And that could open the door to, hey, we need to break camp with a major league roster full of capable major league players. Well, Nathan Lucas fits into that category. And it doesn't mean that he's going to be a cornerstone player for you five years from now. It's probably not going to be the case. But if he can help you for 1 month or for the first 6 weeks of the 2025 regular season, hey, that's 40 games, right? Those 40 games matter. And this is someone who's showing that he can at least handle himself and hold his own at this level, which that's not something to take for granted.
Yeah, and if not, you know, you hold trade value as it when you if you come up and can show that and you pick up five hits over a weekend. Not every team has a bunch of left-handed hitting bench outfielders, right? There are a need for those guys around baseball. Okay. And the other thing is, if you need a 40-man spot, you don't need Nathan Lucas to clear it because you have 37 relievers on your 40-man right now. Ben, I know you have a piece that just went up at sportsnet.ca. You sent it to me early so I could prep for this. How predictable will the Blue Jays be in fixing the bullpen this offseason? We've talked about it a little bit in the past, and we know, you know, the pieces that are still going to be around. They're not going to DFA all of these guys, but they're going to DFA or non-tender a good chunk of them there. So for those who haven't seen your piece up at sportsnet.ca yet, where are you at right now in terms of what the plan is to address this bullpen and how outside of the comfort zone of the last decade plus might Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins have to get in terms of, you know, the way they have traditionally valued bullpen spending in free agency?
Yeah, to me, it's really interesting because it's really obvious to anyone who watches the Blue Jays, to anyone who looks at the numbers, that they need improvement. Their bullpen is objectively one of the worst in baseball, kind of there with the Rockies. So that is a non-tenable position to be in if you're a major league team that's wanting to contend. They need to improve. A lot of those improvements will have to come from outside the organization, because it's not like they have all this talent bubbling up. So where does it come from? It could be trades. It could be free agency. Maybe you get some waiver claims in there. Maybe you get some minor league deals. But you're probably looking at some trades, some free agency. And then you look at the history of how these guys have operated historically. And in the 9 off seasons under Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins, they have not spent more than $11 million guaranteed on any relief pitcher. Chad Green's option was $20 million. That was not technically in free agency. So if you want to count that, the biggest expenditure that they've made on a reliever is $20 million for Chad Green. Then you look at the scale of the commitment, how long it's lasting. They've never guaranteed a reliever 3 years or more. That's in 9 years. So to me, it's just interesting. It reflects that this front office sees the risk in signing relievers to long-term deals and to dishing out significant money there, because they have spent in other ways, but not on relievers. And I get it. I mean, it's justifiable. And they built good bullpens before without necessarily spending big dollars. But if there's ever a time that you would do that, if there's ever a time that you would deviate from that approach, it probably would be this year, because they need the help and they don't have a bubbling up in their own system and they can spend. So I'm not saying you do this every year. Clearly, there are good reasons not to spend on relief every year. But if there's ever a time to do it, I think the Jays need to consider that right now. And I think that they need to be willing to get uncomfortable. And Tanner Scott for 4 years, Estevez for 3 years, Clay Holmes for 3 years. You have to be open to making this kind of deal, even if it's not what you've done before, because you need the help.
What do you make of the fact that, and we've talked a lot about the shortcomings of the system from a pitching development standpoint, but so often, like, if your starters don't work out, they become relievers at least. And they obviously have some names of relative interest. You know, I thought Connor Cook would be here at some point this year. The slider's good, but the results haven't been there. Mason Flaherty doesn't need a 40-man spot until 2025, but he's around at AAA. Hayden Yinger's dealt with some, and Hagen Dettner have both dealt with some injury stuff, but they're around. You know, even when we look at the preseason prospect list, I remember looking at the Baseball America one before the season. I was like, man, that's a lot of relievers for a top 30 system, and that, or a top 30 in a system. And that says bad things about the system overall. But the fact that they haven't really developed in-house stuff since, you know, the Jordan Romano, Tim Mazas, what do you make of that? Because it feels like you would stumble into a reliever or two just from, like, failed starters.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's costly in the end if you don't do that, because we saw the Jays trade away prospects to acquire Jordan Hicks last year. We saw them a couple off seasons ago, they trade away to Oscar Hernandez to upgrade their bullpen and acquire Eric Swanson. So if you don't have relievers in your system, you have to spend somehow on getting them, whether that's by taking away from your offense, taking away from your farm system. Those deals, look, there was a case to be made for making those deals at the time. Certainly with the Hicks deal, I get that. The Teoscar one hasn't worked out, but, you know, there was a reason for doing that at the time. But this is where I go back to free agency, where it sucks. I mean, no one wants to be out there offering four-year deals to relievers. We all understand how volatile they are, but end of the day, it's not going to impact your farm system. It's not going to take away from your major league team. So that's something to consider, as well as trades, because they do have this group of position players in their organization, and there could be an avenue there to trading away from this depth. And I'm not saying it has to be for a reliever, because maybe you actually get a starting pitcher. If you're listening on Spencer Horwitz, I mean, you might get a controllable starting pitcher for him. You might get a corner outfield bat. Maybe you talk to the A's. Maybe there's something with Brent Rooker. Who knows? But, you know, I do think it's a time to be open-minded. And to answer your original question, Blake, I think it comes down to pitching development and drafting. And those are areas where the Jays have not excelled on the pitching side.
And we've already started to hear it starting to filter out the number of changes they're making on the pitching development side. Corey Popham was the name that I believe became public last week or the week prior, one of their minor league pitching coordinators. But apparently there are other changes coming, as you might expect when the only prospects of relevance on your pitching side are on the IL. Right now, Ben, how many home runs do you think Brent Rooker would hit in that Sacramento ballpark? That's literally a PCL ballpark.
Well, he hits like 35 in the major leagues. What was he at this year? 37, something like that.
Is a not super hitter friendly park.
Right. I'll say 40. I think he would hit 40. I think that Brent Rooker's a good player. Is he a great player? I don't know, but he is a very, very good player.
He is, and his 37 right now would be exactly 37 in Toronto, but would be 42 in Anaheim, and then as high as 46 if he played in Milwaukee, just based on the profile and stuff like that. So 46 in a barn like Milwaukee, you drop it into a minor league ballpark in a PCL environment. I don't know. I might say 45. Might say he gets it, but I also can't imagine that the A's team with where they are, that he's an A the entirety of next year, but something to have on your fantasy radar for next year, Ben. 45 homers from Brent Rooker in Sacramento.
Yeah, that's that situation in Sacramento is really interesting. And, you know, we've heard Scott Boras make comments on this. It is from the standpoint of players and just their own lives and trying to prepare their families, trying to play and perform in what's said to be an extremely hot environment, you know, no dome, middle of the summer. I mean, there's a lot going on there. And I think the players would rightfully have some questions about how that's going to look.
The visiting team facilities are in center field, which is not going to fly super well with some of these teams. And apparently they're going to have to renovate the home side as well. It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. And also very, very frustrating as a baseball fan. If someone was doing that to my team, I would be having punk music shows in the parking lot and chirping them all the time as well. Ben Nicholson-Smith, thanks for taking the time out this morning, man.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, Blake.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of At the Letters. Yeah, we're getting close to the Oakland A's final home game here in Oakland, which sucks. Sucks what John Fisher's done to that team. Sucks that the business plan is so bad that you can't even get free money out of the state of Nevada, who don't seem to be that conservative when it comes to financials and things like that. Speaking of that, by the way, the UFC at Sphere on the weekend looked incredible. It was very cool and one of the best cards from an in-ring perspective of all time. Excited to see more stuff at Sphere. I wonder if, I don't know how they would do it, and I know the NHL draft was already held there, but NBA has such deep roots in Vegas with marquee events and things like that, that I have to imagine they're going to do something with Sphere at some point, whether it's a draft or something else. Anyway, let's take a break. Let's get back to talking about baseball. I'm all over the place today. It's one of those Mondays, I guess. It was one of those weekends. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Zach Kreiser. We'll check in on the Rangers, who the Blue Jays are going to see this week for a three set, which includes the return of Jacob deGrom, the return of Max Scherzer, the debut of Kumar Rocker, a lot going on in Texas, and a very interesting team heading into 2025 looking for a bounce back, just like the Blue Jays. We'll also talk to Kiri Oler and Leo Morgenstern in the second half of the show. No Jays game tonight, so we'll just kind of whip around baseball, talk ball. Nothing wrong with that. Zach Kreiser joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays off today, but then they'll see the Rangers for three. We don't have Jays probable pitchers yet as they still figure out where to get those that extra day or extra days of rest for their main guys with 12 games to go here. But on the Texas side, it'll be Nate Eovaldi, Cody Bradford, and Kumar Rocker, who had a really cool debut last week. Also returning this weekend for them was Jacob deGrom. And Max Scherzer. So a lot to talk about with the Texas Rangers. Let's talk to Zach Kreiser of OPTA, of D Magazine, of Baseball Prospectus. Zach, how we doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Before we talk all this Rangers stuff, there's something way more pressing I got to ask you about. How do you like the new MJ Lenderman album?
I love the new MJ Lenderman album. Yeah, if people haven't heard of this guy yet, every publication I subscribed to wrote about him within a two-week period, so hopefully people got the memo, but he's a great inflection of, like, Neil Young old school and kind of new age country southern rock, so he's just terrific.
Yeah, it's good stuff, and songs about MJ's flu game and things like that. There's stuff sprinkled in there for us, for sure. Zach, okay, let's talk Texas Rangers. Jacob deGrom returned on the weekend. You wrote a great piece at D Magazine about him kind of returning to a world that he helped shape. What did you, for our listeners who didn't get a chance to read that piece yet, what do you mean by that? How do you contextualize what Jacob deGrom, or how he's kind of symbolized the change in pitching over the course of his career?
Yeah, I thought it was something I'd wanted to write about for a while, because I think when he got injured again, you know, he gets injured occasionally and he's out for a while and then he comes back and everyone's like, wow, this guy's so great. And he is. But I think this most recent time when he underwent his second Tommy John surgery, there was a lot of the immediate reaction was sort of, you know, he would have been a Hall of Famer maybe, but now it's going to be abbreviated and he's not really going to stack up to the pitchers he needs to kind of be remembered in a certain way. And I think my point now that he is back and with all of the guys we've seen get hurt in the middle and with the way pitching has changed in the middle of him being gone, which is more and more guys are coming up trying to pitch exactly like Jacob deGrom, and more guys getting hurt at the same rate that Jacob deGrom is, I think we're going to see kind of Jacob deGrom's career, maybe as an accentuated version of it, but as sort of the way elite pitching works now. You know, if you're going to try to throw 98 mile per hour fastballs and 92 mile per hour sliders, you're going to have this thing where maybe your average innings per season is closer to 120 than to 200. And all of the guys we've seen reach that kind of elite apex, like Shane McClanahan, Tyler Glasnow, we can talk about the Dodgers later as an example of this, but they're not hitting those 200 innings. You know, we have some guys who are still doing that, but I think that's going to be the exception to the rule if pitching keeps going the way it is. And I think there's a lot of kind of discussion points around whether that's good or not, but just as the reality of what pitchers are going for right now, they are trying to be Jacob DeGrom, and they are okay with the risks of what he's gone through. So,
yeah, and how could you not be, right? Like, obviously, everyone would love to pitch 3,000 innings and have the longevity, but Jacob DeGrom had one of the best seven-year peaks that we have seen and will see, especially when we adjust for the context of the era and things. Like, he had a 170 ERA over 217 innings in 2018, hit a 9-win season as a pitcher, and got the big money deal. So if you are a pitcher looking at an example, how do you not? Even if, yeah, the last four seasons, he hasn't even cracked 95 innings at any point. So, Zach, turning to the DeGrom specifics of this, he comes back in that game. It's only 3 2/3 innings, but all the like pitch modeling metrics and things like that are all basically like, yeah, this is still Jacob DeGrom. His stuff plus in that outing was 152, where 100 is league average. What do you make of, you know, and this is a year where we've seen Chris Sale at age 35 have his first terrific elite and fully healthy season since like he was 30. What do you make of where things go for Jacob DeGrom for next year? Because this is, obviously he's under contract for a few more years, and the Rangers could, you know, use him pretty good if they're going to bounce back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point about Chris Sale, and that's exactly where I was going to go with it. We don't really have any reason to think that DeGrom won't be an elite-level pitcher on an inning-per-inning basis. I mean, his velocity is like 90% of where it was when he got hurt. His slider still looks the same. He's still putting it on that same corner where no one can touch it. I think you have to look at the Rangers and say, okay, they're probably going to get elite Jacob DeGrom. The question is how much of it, you know, how much are they willing to push him innings-wise? Are they going to, is there any strategy they're going to try to keep him healthy, or are they just going to say, let's roll with it until it breaks again? But yeah, you have to say Jacob DeGrom is probably an ace for the Rangers next year. And the question is really just how many innings of it is he an ace? And that's kind of a pretty good outlook for them in terms of trying to bounce back. I think you already are looking at a position player group that had a pretty down year compared to expectations, so it wouldn't be a surprise if that bounced back. So I think you're talking about Jacob DeGrom as a top five pitcher in baseball at the very minimum next year in terms of rate stats, and the question is whether it's 100 innings, 150 innings, or 180 innings.
Yeah, and then obviously if you have a concern like that, you need to make sure that your depth is in good shape. And obviously Scherzer, who also returned on the weekend, is a free agent. Andrew Heaney's a free agent, but they have a couple of guys who are going to be around still. John Gray will be back. And then there is the fact that they have Jack Leiter and Kumar Rocker. Now, Jack Leiter pitched out of the bullpen on Saturday. He was kind of the long man behind Scherzer, which maybe is the plan the rest of the way here. Are you buying on Kumar Rocker and Jack Leiter as guys who can be, you know, if the Rangers want to get back to the playoffs into the World Series next year, you can come into the year with those guys as your 4-5 or 5-6 comfortably?
I think I'm more comfortable with Rocker than I am with Leiter. I mean, Leiter did pretty well in the minors, but his major league outings have not inspired confidence that stuff and his command is ready to play. Maybe he'll come into next year and take a step forward. I don't think that would be some huge surprise if he stepped forward into kind of a little bit of a boom or bust number four type who's a little prone to the homer. But Kumar Rocker, I think, you know, I don't want to get I don't think people should be over their skis about the first start, which was obviously very impressive with the strikeouts. I think guys are going to adjust at least a little bit to spotting that slider, which is nasty. But major league hitters are not going to swing at that out of the zone at the rate they are right now because they're going to learn to spot that a little bit. But I do think Rocker looks like a very solid, you know, I think he might be a number three type. If I were making like his most likely projection, I could see him as kind of a strikeout heavy number three who does give up some walks and some hits, but keeps things in line. I kind of like him for that staff. And then, yeah, you're right. They've been aggressive in adding depth in the past, and I would expect that Chris Young, newly promoted to president of baseball operations, does the same thing, finds some more depth arms on the free agent market on shorter term deals, and they try to fill that in as much as they can.
Yeah, they're in a good spot, it looks like, on paper to bounce back. Like you alluded to the position player side there and how kind of it's been a what could go wrong would go wrong. And you look at all these guys individually and you're like, yeah, that guy'll be better next year. Maybe that guy's healthier. Wyatt Langford's a year older, et cetera. I think they're in a good spot. And Kumar Rocker, who knows? Maybe he's in the rookie of the year mix next year, which is just a way of pivoting to another thing you wrote recently, Zach, which is about the National League rookie of the year race. You had a great breakdown of it for Opta the other day. And obviously this is a lot of Paul Skeens talk this year because he's had 120 of the most incredible innings you could have for a rookie starting pitcher. Comes up in 1 year after his draft. He is starting for the National League in the All-Star game, but it's a pretty deep class in the National League, and Jackson Merrill's been pretty damn good too. You laid out a good case for Merrill there. How do you feel about the National League Rookie of the Year race here 2 weeks out from the finish line?
Yeah, I think the thing with the National League race is there are like four right answers. You know, there is not a wrong answer here. I think there are four different guys who would win the American League Rookie of the Year who all play in the National League. I mean, in addition to Merrill and Skeens, you've got Shota Imanaga and Jackson Chourio who would be great candidates if there weren't these two other amazing candidates. So, yeah, I don't think there's a wrong answer. I wanted to lay out the case for Merrill because I think that there's kind of this trend that people are starting to pick up on but maybe haven't fully grasped, which is just how difficult it is to be a young hitter right now. The gap between the minor leagues and the major leagues is bigger than it has been in recent memory. You know, in terms of the research I've been trying to do, it's a hard topic to really get your head around definitively, but I don't think the gap has been this big since maybe the expansion that brought in the Devil Rays back in the day. I think that the ability to gauge and improve pitching, and Skeens is a great example of this actually, is just so definitive. The technology is so precise that, you know, you can have a guy like Skeens who's, he was obviously supernaturally talented before, but they got him in the minor leagues. They help him develop this consistent, amazing sinker-splitter combination. And it's like, okay, this guy's ready for the majors. Let's put him there. So you have the pitchers moving really fast. And then the hitters, you also have them moving fast because they're not facing any good pitching in the minors. So they race up to the majors. And then the pitching changes dramatically. And for a lot of guys, they even have to go back down to figure it out. Merrill is a good case of a guy who kind of worked through some meh months in April and then really took off and has been on the path toward an elite hitter, I would say. You know, if you look at his year compared to the similar age and track record of like Bobby Witt Jr., Gunnar Henderson, like he's on that level of trajectory in terms of matching up with pitching. So that was basically my case. I don't know if he'll win. I don't know who I would vote for even, but I do think, you know, his trajectory is impressive in its own way, even if it doesn't kind of punch you in the face the way Skeens does.
Yeah, and then, I mean, this is, you know, it's probably those two at the top of most ballots, but Jackson Chourio, who is just 20, is in there as well. And to your point about it being a difficult adjustment, that's a guy who only had six games at AAA before getting the major league call. And his first 150 plate appearances or so, he looked overmatched. The Brewers had the patience with it. And now he's, I believe, the first 20 and under player to go 20-20. He's got 21 home runs and 20 stolen bases and 28 doubles. And it's been worth almost four wins with him as well. How close is, obviously, Merrill, like you said, is on the Bobby Witt Jr. trajectory. Like, he is on, like, a super-duper star trajectory. What have you made of Jackson Chourio's rookie season and how close he might be able to get to a level like that in time as well?
Yeah, I think he's just a more dramatic example of that, where he had even less seasoning coming into the year, and they kind of popped him into the lineup and wanted to see how he would do. And the first couple months were rough, but you could argue that he's had an even bigger swing upward than Merrill has. Just it took him a little longer to get there. And I mean, he's a complete absolute athletic marvel. I mean, this is a, if he wants to be, this could be a Ronald Acuna Jr. starter kit. This could be, you know, I think he's got some plate discipline work to do to fully get there. But I think, you know, he has shown that he's already leveled up beyond some guys who maybe you could have compared him to a Luis Robert at the beginning of the year or something like that. But I think I already buy his consistency and his approach and his contact ability a little bit more than that. So I think, yeah, you're looking at a future MVP candidate in Churio too. They have not had him play center field a lot. He's kind of been shifting between the corners. And I think that'll be an interesting thing to see is what they think about his defense or whether they envision him kind of bulking up and being more of a power bat. But I think he's on a tremendous track too. And like you said, he's actually the youngest of this entire bunch. And so you've got a lot of room to grow there. I think especially with combining the home runs and the speed, that's a guy who's going to be just a real, real enjoyable watch for years and years and years in Milwaukee.
I went back and I tried to find a rookie class isolated to one league, like the American League or National League, that had this many guys who were this promising and like this level of war and stuff like that. And there's like 2015 in the American League had Carlos Correa and Francisco Lindor, which is like really high watermark. And just as a part of the process of going through this, I stumbled on the 2006 National League rookie class, Hanley Ramirez, Andre Ethier, Josh Johnson, Russell Martin, and more. Man, this looks like one of those historic rookie draft or rookie classes though, for the National League. Over on the American League side, there are some guys, if we sort by wins above replacement, we use that. There are some guys who, you know, are having really solid rookie seasons. Nobody on the level, I don't think, of Merrill and Skeens in terms of impact and things like that. What do you make, though, of the top of the AL class where there's Austin Wells, obviously power hitting catcher, hitting in the middle of the Yankees order, Colton Cowser, and then to a lesser extent, Willier Abreu. And I mean, none of the pitchers really pop that much as I'd love to stump for Cade Smith as a Canadian. What have you made of the American League side of this race?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll come down to Cowser and Wells. And if it were my vote, you know, I think Cowser has been a more impressive all-around performer. And he's played a good center field. He has hit and, you know, he has a very high strikeout rate, but he's done enough. And the thing with Wells, I do think he's going to be a great player for the Yankees. And he's handled his defensive ability, his defensive responsibilities well and kind of gotten better as a hitter as the year went on, but they are still really, really platooning him. He has not seen much left-handed pitching. And I think, you know, whether it's fair or not, I'm kind of holding that against him in the race of Cowser has had to hit against everyone, even against pitchers who he might not be as good against. And Wells's line reflects a little bit of protection where they have not put him out there much against good left-handed pitching or left-handed pitching at all. So that's a little bit of a tiebreaker for me where I'd lean Cowser, but I would not be surprised if Austin Wells has a really great career.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's nice that Red Sox and Yankees fans get to go insane at each other, and it's maybe an Orioles guy who's going to sneak in and take the American League race. That, from an entertainment, from an outside perspective, that's the funniest outcome here. Zach, I know you also broke down recently the last of these playoff races here. The Yankees are three games up in the American League East now. That they have, at the latest Fangraphs odds, 88% to win the division. The third wild card there is not all that tight, but we have a tie between the Mets and the Braves. How are you feeling about these last couple races? Like, where is your focus night to night when you lock in to watch games these last 2 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I've been surprised at how close the Twins are making this harder on themselves than mm-hmm. they should. But yeah, I agree that the National League wildcard race is the most intriguing thing. I mean, hopefully Francisco Lindor is healthy and the Mets and Braves can kind of duel this out the rest of the way. They play each other a few more times, so that's going to be the biggest one, although, you know, you're also looking at the Padres and the Diamondbacks in that race, that they're not that far ahead, but they've been playing amazing baseball, and the seeding and the matchups there is just, that's going to be a really interesting thing coming down the stretch, because I think the Padres and the Diamondbacks might enter as kind of two of the biggest threats in the National League. I still think the Phillies will go in as the favorite in the league just because of their starting pitching and the durability there. But you have to at least watch the Padres and the Diamondbacks as I mean, they are playing amazing baseball. The Diamondbacks hit better than anyone else in that league. And so I think the Mets and Braves will be the closest race, but there's some other stuff at stake there in terms of the seeding that will really count once we actually flip the calendar.
Yeah, it's not, I think it's the least likely scenario, but there's a Churio versus Merrill series on the possibility tree there as well, which would be cool given our National League Rookie of the Year conversation. Zach, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Enjoy these playoff races.
Thank you.
Zach Reiser of OPTA, of D Magazine, of Baseball Prospectus. A lot of good work from him. Make sure you're giving him a follow on Twitter heading into playoff season here at Zed Kreiser or Z Kreiser. I don't know. Said to me, see to them. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Kiri Oler of Fangraphs. She was formerly in the Twins and Phillies front office, now doing some work at Fangraphs. We will whip around baseball in general. She did some really interesting work recently on pitcher predictability. So a guy like Chris Bassitt is not predictable because he throws 8 different pitches and throws them all in different counts and things like that. A guy like Kevin Gausman, more or less 2 pitches, and you have an idea of what's coming when. How does that play out? How do we measure that? What effect does that have on outcomes and things like that? We'll whip around a little bit, and we'll talk about some microwave burritos. I'll explain that with Kiri after the break as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays sweep the Cardinals. No action tonight. Then they'll visit Texas. Almost there. 12 games left. They'll visit Texas, visit the Rays. Then they host the Red Sox and Marlins last week to wrap it up. And then we, of course, wrap it up. It's back to basketball for me. And WNBA playoffs start next week as well. So we'll probably sprinkle a little bit of that into. We'll have the Liberty gear out in full force. Let's talk baseball, though. Let's talk to Kiri Oler of Fangraphs, formerly of the Twins and the Phillies, also at the next. Kiri, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Love the bandana. How are you enjoying the transition back to writing for the public sphere, doing things at Fangraphs? I know you were on the team side for a couple of years there. How are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's been great. It's nice to just kind of be able to dig into whatever I think is interesting. Like, obviously, there's a lot of like job satisfaction that comes from working for a team, but you are kind of like at the beck and call of like what other folks think is important as well. And now I just kind of get to pull out all the threads that I'm interested in. And I also think it's really important to have like a lot of good public research out there as well for the fan experience. So it's been fun.
It's great. I'm very much enjoying reading your stuff. Also, looking at your visuals, I know you, well, like when you were working with the Phillies, I remember, I think you were on the SIS baseball podcast and you talked about the difference between people who want like the charts and the visuals. Were you doing things like some of the quirky visuals you do at Fangraphs on the team side? Or is that a little too far? Like, hey, this is our guy who looks like mac and cheese now. This is our burrito guy.
Yeah, I tried to sneak it in where I could. It was sort of one of those like know your audience things. Like yeah. Some folks were more open to that than others. So I did when I could. But yeah, there was a little bit less receptiveness to that kind of thing.
In seriousness, though, on the team side, and I guess this is a public sphere thing, too, for fans and media and things like that, but that ability to not just communicate, but find the way that, hey, player X or coach Y or front office person Z communicates and can take that information, is that, like, every team except the Rockies has good data and things like that. Is that kind of, like, where the value is going to come from right now with where we are in terms of baseball analytics, like the ability to communicate and kind of mobilize the information for each audience?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's super crucial. I will acknowledge, like, I have a little bias as a former teacher that like, I obviously think the communication aspect of it is super crucial, but I also did like in my time in baseball, see a lot of the struggle with like, there were really good ideas. We had really strong research, really strong data supporting stuff, but not getting buy-in. And I really feel like it was based on like almost a de-emphasis on like being able to communicate this stuff well. And like, you can have all the good science and all the good research that you want, but if you can't get the players and the coaches and everybody on the same page and in agreement that this is actually the best way forward, it's going to be really hard to implement that stuff with any type of consistency. And given that it is based on like averages and things playing out over time, you do need to be consistent with it.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I'd imagine it's a big challenge for someone in the role that you had. And then also a challenge at the, you know, if it's coming top down, it's a challenge at the bottom to understand that stuff. And it's always fascinating, like now in 2024, like talking to pitchers or whatever, all of them just like use the vocabulary, and you can tell that there's some bottom up stuff with the analytics too, like a curiosity of, hey, help me get better at this. What are we looking at with that? Okay, so I wanted to ask you about a piece that you wrote recently that gets to some of this, and it's pitcher predictability. What are you throwing in what count? What pitch are you throwing when? The piece was called The Search for the Most Predictable Pitcher over at Fangraphs. So you mentioned earlier that you just kind of get to pull at threads now and write what you're curious about. Was this a case of that as well? Like something, you know, hey, why are we throwing this in what count? Like what led you down the road with this one?
Yeah, I think it goes back to a larger fascination that I have just with pitch sequencing in general. And in the past, I have a tendency to kind of like go straight to like the galaxy brain idea and bite off more than I can chew. Whereas with this project, I tried to like bring it all the way back and like, I'm going to start at the most basic component of this, which is like throwing pitches in certain counts, which I also know is how pitchers think about the problem. So think about it in that sense first. And then, you know, I may in the future layer on that more like sequencing specific type of stuff. But I really wanted to just think about like the concept of pitch sequencing in this like predictability context and see how much predictability is a factor in the effectiveness of sequencing and how much, you know, guys can rely on their stuff or different locations and, you know, moving things around, maybe tweaking your shapes a little bit, but it's still technically the same pitch, you know, that type of thing. Sort of just like get my arms around it on a basic level. And then, you know, in the future, maybe I'll layer onto that.
So, yeah. So for anyone who hasn't read the piece yet, it goes something kind of like this. Okay, well, Jose Quijada throws a fastball 94% of the time. You have a good idea fastball is coming no matter what the count is or whatever. If you're Kevin Gausman and you throw, you know, the fastball splitter combo makes up 85% of what you're throwing and probably even a little higher in key count situations, you know, how does a hitter figure that out? How does that impact things versus, again, to use a Toronto example, Chris Bassett throws 8 or 9 different pitches. Good luck figuring that out. So what was, you know, and again, people can go read the piece, but when you dove into it, that level of predictability, when you looked at the leaders, who is most and least predictable and in certain situations and things like that, did it line up with kind of like where your priors were? Like, did it meet expectations of like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, this guy, it feels predictable. That guy feels unpredictable.
Yeah, I think like the thing that most like intuitively made sense is that guys who don't throw that many pitches are going to be more predictable. Like there's just less to choose from as opposed to guys who have, you know, 4 or 5 pitches that they'll throw 10% plus of the time. So that all tracked for me. I think what was maybe surprising or maybe just like something I wanted to like test with this whole way of looking at it is whether or not like being predictable actually seemed to correlate with ineffectiveness. And it really didn't, you know, like there were pitchers who only throw 2 pitches, but were still like really good pitchers. Like I think Justin Steele was one of the ones that was highlighted in the piece. And, you know, like he primarily throws 2 pitches, but yet he's still very, very good. Or Dylan Cease was the same way. So like you can be very good only throwing 2 pitches. You can be very good throwing 5 or 6 pitches. And it really just depends on how you execute that.
Yeah. And Justin Steele's a fascinating example because then we get into, this would be several layers down, I think, but like variability within a pitch where Justin Steele's 4-seam fastball is like, I don't know, it's kind of like 3 different fastballs if you look like the spin shapes and things like that. And it was a great example. You used Justin Steele against Seth Lugo, where the outcomes are almost identical and they come at it from completely different ways. When you look at this, I was speaking with someone last week about some of the early work that's being done on like deception and, you know, how you hide the ball. And obviously tunneling is something that's very popular. When we look at gaps between, hey, ERA and expected ERA, again, to use the Jays example, Berríos and Bassett have beat their expected ERAs for years and years and years now, both of them, whereas Kevin Gausman maybe doesn't as much. Do you think there is a component of this, even if obviously Justin Steele can succeed with having primarily 2 pitches, that this maybe gets to an element of that gap between actual and expected that we see with some guys where there is a level of, I guess, off-balanceness that you create with hitters?
Yeah. I think that can be part of it. I think like what you said about deception and tunneling, like that makes a lot of sense too. That was something that I thought about when I was like, well, you know, in theory, these guys are really predictable. It should be easier to hit them. But if their two pitches look exactly the same until the pitch is, you know, 10 feet in front of the plate, that's too late for a hitter to decide, you know, like they've already committed one way or another. So, yeah, so I think like not just the pitches themselves, but you know the trajectory of the pitch, how they look coming out of the pitcher's hand, like those type of things can make a difference. And if they are able to like keep the hitters off balance, and whether that's with sequencing, whether it's with location, you know, there are little things that a pitcher can do to keep hitters guessing. And one of the things that I would like to get to in the future with this project is, instead of using pitch types as the predictability metric, just look more at pitch shapes and pitch characteristics and not worry as much about the type, given how, you know, one guy's slider can be very different from another guy's slider. And then you've got sweepers and all of this other stuff in the mix. So like really just focusing more on the characteristics of the pitch than getting hung up on the labels, I think would be another interesting layer to add to this.
Yeah. And locations. Hey, this guy's going to try to bury his curveball every time there's two strikes and there isn't three balls. You know, you can run into that. And then I think you mentioned, you alluded to earlier there, like not all, you know, maybe not all 2-2 counts are created equal, right? The way you get there maybe has an effect on this as well.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So another thing that you wrote about recently, and this is much more relevant now because we're 2 weeks out from the playoffs, and you did this great allusion to microwave burritos and postseason success. So the crux of this is it better to be a team that has offensive players who are really consistent? Hey, this guy is going to go 1-for-3 every day, and you know what you're getting exactly every time. Or is it better to have streakier hitters who can get hot but might be cold? And the outcome of your piece was a little surprising to me because I thought maybe that the cold streaks would be just too damaging. But the way that it turned out from this article is you're actually in a little bit better shape if you have, obviously with some caveats, guys got to get hot at the right time, but that streakiness isn't as damaging as maybe my personal feeling or our collective read as a baseball media on that level of consistency in the playoffs. What did you take from that article and your research on what lineups are successful in the postseason?
Yeah, I was similarly surprised. I would have expected, you know, consistent hitters to be more useful in the playoffs kind of across the board. But, you know, having streaky hitters, but it, particularly if you can have like multiple of them on a lineup, then you are less reliant on like your one star hitter who is a little bit streaky getting hot at the right time. So there's that to consider with it. And that sort of is what led me to like part two of that piece, which was, okay, like we can look at individual hitters in a vacuum and evaluate individual performance and see that, you know, on the individual level, the streaky hitters are doing as good or better than they do in the regular season. But, you know, sequencing is obviously super crucial in the postseason. So on a team level, you know, based on the composition of your entire lineup, what do you want that composition to look like? Do you want it to be all streaky hitters? Do you want it to be more consistent? And what that piece found is that, you know, in the context of a full lineup hitting in sequence with one another, having at least some consistent hitters in the lineup is still very helpful. So I felt a little affirmed once I got to part two and was like, okay, I'm not totally insane. Like consistency does still have value.
Yeah. The sequencing thing is so important though, right? Like if everyone in the lineup goes 1-for-3, you think that's great. We hit 333, you know, we got 9 hits, but if each one of those hits came in a different inning, you got 0 runs, right? Unless someone is getting hot and going on a heater. And then, yeah, that led you to the Doug Funny approach to roster construction, which I thought was a hilarious framing of it as, yeah, everyone looks the same. So you mentioned a little earlier, when on the team side, a part of the challenge of this is a lot of the analysis is based on averages and what's going to happen over a large sample and things like that. And you use the quote in this piece from Billy Bean in Moneyball, my stuff doesn't work in the playoffs. In an era where we have additional playoff spots now, and obviously there's still a huge value to winning the division and getting that bye through the first round. But theoretically, more teams can make the playoffs. If you are a very, very good team, you could accept a little additional downside in the regular season because there are more spots than there were before. Do you think we're heading toward teams being able to be a little bit more mindful of what might work in the playoffs? Where like the Dodgers are obviously the great counterexample of 11 years in a row with only one bizarro championship. Do you think the extra wild card spots could let some teams move there a little bit if they're really, really certain they're going to get there?
Yeah, I think that does sort of open the door to, I mean, like you want to, like you need to build a team that can win in the regular season, because if you don't get to the postseason, then it doesn't matter what your roster construction looks like. But I do think that there are teams like the Dodgers, you know, maybe you could put the Phillies in this category where like they've got a really strong roster that they are building on. So maybe some of their offseason planning can go into, okay, like we clearly have a roster that's strong enough to make the postseason. What sort of adjustments can we make on the edges to try and tweak what we have to make it so that we're a little bit more insulated to the randomness of the postseason? There's always going to be a certain amount of randomness. I think you want that. I think it's good. It's exciting, all of that. But, you know, from the team side, like they don't want randomness. They want to win. So, you know, how can you like minimize as much of that as possible? And so some of that might actually be like, hey, we need some like streaky hot hitters that will, you know, can get hot at the right time and put us over the top.
Yeah. And I wonder if that plays into the Dodgers pitching strategy where they're just so willing to embrace risk on the pitching side because they have an unlimited budget. Obviously, it hasn't worked out for them. But in theory, if all those guys happen to be healthy at once, you never score a run on them. It just so turns out that none of them are ever healthy. Okay. I wanted to whip around a couple of other things. Oh, actually, sorry. This was one related question. Within that piece, the Doug Funny piece, you talked about Mario and Wario streaks, so good streaks and bad streaks. And when you went about quantifying or capturing, you know, what's a hot streak, what's a cold streak, you had mentioned there's that interesting, like, in between. It's neither, it's a transition period or whatever. This is maybe something you have to do after, but are we able to identify in any way if one of those is coming? Like, were there indicators of like, hey, a better streak is coming? Is that something we would be able to have an eye on, or is it too random? Like, I don't know. It struck me as a question, but I have no idea how you would tackle the problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's something I've thought about a little bit. I've thought about it more in the context of like rest and load management, like, and more predicting when a slump is coming as opposed to predicting when a hot streak might be coming. So, yeah, I think there might be indicators. I'm not sure if they are more related to, like, fatigue or that type of thing, or if, you know, maybe there's just indicators in certain hitters' approach that might tell you, like, when they're seeing the ball well and when things are about to turn around for them. We talk more about pitching peripherals when, you know, we're looking at, you know, FIP versus ERA and things like that. But I think there are peripherals for hitters too in their approach and just in like the contact quality that they're making, even if they're not necessarily seeing great results from that. So I think there might be indicators. That is something I'd be interested in researching more, so I don't have like any hard conclusions on that. But I think the door is at least open that could be possible as something to predict.
And you mentioned load management, and obviously that's something you've written about as well. The kind of indicators, like we don't have, you know, velocity for a player, but now that we have bat speed data, maybe that's a little heads up. And you know, I appreciated the piece that you did, and I was like thinking, could I send this to my bosses and be like, maybe it applies to me too? You know, we should all get a little bit of a break as well. What have you made generally? I know you've written a couple pieces using bat speed data, including the great All-American Rejects reference one. We have a year of bat speed data now. You know, I'm pretty fascinated what it's going to look like when we have multiple years. And you know, does that help us understand player aging and decline and things like that? What have you made of 1 year with the data, and where are your kind of curiosities with it moving forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, given that it is just 1 year, I've been trying to sort of limit myself to the type of things that you could reasonably conclude based on such a short amount of time. And so, you know, with the initial piece that I wrote about it, like I really just wanted to know like what's a reasonable sample size for measuring, you know, for bat speed to be meaningful. And so that's sort of where I wanted to start with that. And then, you know, I think there are it's easy to get sort of over your skis with bat speed because it feels like a linear measurement where like line go up, it's good, but it's not necessarily. So it can be a tricky one to analyze. And so that's sort of why I wanted to stick to with like the first thing that I kind of looked at with that was like the more like load management fatigue factor and what you could take from that and really just like comparing hitters to themselves, as opposed to trying to necessarily like delineate between hitters based on bat speed. I think as we get that larger sample, it'll be easier to define the relationships between that value and other values relating to their outcomes and then compare hitters to one another. But I think in the short term, it's hard to do that. And then, but then going forward, like you're saying, I think we'll be able to learn more about hitters and say more about what type of hitters there are once we have that larger span of data. And like you said, maybe use it as an aging indicator as well.
Yeah. And even just the preliminary stuff you've done, like I found it fascinating. Like, hey, you've played a bunch of games in a row, you get an off day, your bat speed might tick back up. It's like, even in the early going, we have some indicators that like, yeah, this stuff backs up common sense. It's nice. And then we'll be able to quantify it. Okay. This is, so you've worked for two teams. Are you able to like be a fan of it? Like, is there a team that you root for, or have you kind of put that aside now?
Yeah. I mean, I have a fondness for both of the teams that I worked for, in part because like, I still know people who work there and I want good things for them and all of that. So like, I still have a fondness for both of those teams. Before I ever started working for a team, I was an Orioles fan. So it's been nice to dip back into that fandom a little bit, especially now that they are back on the uptick. It was nice. They sort of had their like down period the whole time I was working for teams. So I was fine, like not paying attention to them. It was fine. So yeah, I would say I still have like a moderate fandom for, you know, those three teams. But I also just really enjoy consuming the sport as a whole.
Well, this is great. You have three of the 12 playoff teams with the Twins, the Phillies, and the Orioles. So you're going to be set the next couple of weeks. Okay, this is a random one. I know you've done some WNBA stuff as well. At All-Star Weekend, you talk to people, and obviously Ellie the Elephant is the best mascot. I'm a Liberty fan. How are you feeling heading into the playoffs? And do you have a WNBA team as well?
Yeah, I'm based in the Seattle area, so okay. I'm a Storm fan. So, yeah, excited for them to get into the playoffs. So, yeah, I think the playoffs will be really exciting. It's an exciting time to be a WNBA fan. Glad to hear that y'all are excited over there and covering it. I know Toronto's getting the expansion team, so that'll be all the more reason to get stoked on the W.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have one of the best mascots on the men's side. No one's going to match Ellie, but the bar is set extremely high there.
Yeah, and they shouldn't try, which is a note to the Sky's new lion mascot. Like, you could absolutely, like, take advantage of, like, the enthusiasm around mascots, but you got to do your own thing. You got to carve your own path there.
Yeah, it's a good lesson for it. Look, every league is a copycat league, but you don't need to do that with the mascots as well. Kiri, thank you so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate this.
Yeah, no, it was great. Thanks for having me.
Kiri Oler of Fangraphs and the Next, formerly with the Twins and the Phillies organizations, as well. We'll talk a little Phillies in our last segment. We're going to talk to Leo Morgenstern. A little update on the playoff picture there. The Phillies, by the way, are the first team in baseball to win 90 games here. No one's going to win 100 games here. There's a possibility no one even wins 95 in the American League, which, you know, I don't know. It's going to be weird to look at the standings and see that. Also, if you look at the American League wildcard standings, would have been a good year to be a reasonably good wildcard team, given that the Minnesota Twins don't seem to want that last spot. Tigers and the Mariners have played a little better of late, but not super eager to jump in there. The Twins are 2.5 up on those teams, by the way, the Tigers and Mariners. So as much as that feels like they're in control here, 12, 13 games is a lot of baseball. The Tigers don't play the Twins anywhere in their remaining schedule, so they're a little less in control of what they're looking at there. And then, yeah, the Yankees move three games ahead of the Orioles on the weekend. So they're looking at almost 90% odds of locking up that division. Now, over in the NL, though, the Braves and the Mets are exactly where we left them, still tied for that wild card spot. The Diamondbacks are two games clear of them, and then no one else is really in the race. But this Mets-Braves thing, probably going to come down to the wire until that series between the two teams next week. Now, Francisco Lindor left the game injured on the weekend. He's set for an MRI, so a lot to keep an eye on there. We're going to do, look, the Jays got 12 games left. It's great they swept the Cardinals. They are 72-78, though, and we're at the end of a trying season here. We're going to talk a lot about the playoff picture the rest of the way here because there are 13, arguably 15 teams still with some playoff relevance here. And also, one other team chasing history. The Chicago White Sox are going to, even though they've won two in a row now, are almost certainly going to break the record for most losses in a season. Let's talk about some of that. Let's talk about the Phillies. Let's talk about the playoff races with Leo Morgenstern next. As Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Your daily dose of everything NFL. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Please don't text me about the Jacksonville Jaguars in the text line. That's not what the text line is for. It is for about baseball. I don't want to talk about the Jacksonville Jaguars or Trevor Lawrence. I want to talk about baseball. I want to talk about another team that has not won very much over the last little bit. Let's talk to Leo Morgenstern of Fangraphs and Just Baseball and MLB Trade Rumors. Leo, good morning, man. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so I'm catching up on your stuff this morning. Make sure I haven't missed any articles and things like that. And I click on your MLB Trade Rumors page, and the first thing that's there is the White Sox plan to cut payroll next year after they will, I mean, assuming they don't go on an absolute heater here, they're going to set the record for most losses in a season and then cut the payroll. I know you have to be a professional at MLB Trade Rumors. You have to present the information as it is. How tempted were you to just rip Jerry Reinsdorf and the White Sox a new one, seeing that one come down?
I mean, it's definitely an inflammatory title. And I kind of, as soon as I put it out, I felt a little bit bad. Because
no.
The truth is, it's really not quite as bad as it seems. I'm not defending Reinsdorf. I'm not defending what the White Sox are doing right now. But they do have like over $100 million coming off the books at the end of this season. They've got a lot of big contracts. Yoan Moncada is the biggest one. A lot of guys who they dealt at the deadline, who what they paid them before the deadline is still in the White Sox payroll. So really the point is that unless the White Sox were to go out and be one of the biggest spenders on the free agent market this winter, their 2025 payroll would be lower than their 2024 payroll. So I don't want to read too much into those comments, that reports. I don't know. I mean, Getz has also said recently he's not planning to spend big in free agency. But to be honest, did we really expect them to before any of this came out? The White Sox are incredibly disappointing. They're going to be incredibly disappointing next year. But I don't necessarily think cutting payroll is quite as dramatic as it might sound at first thought.
Yeah, it's like, look, some of the stuff you just outlined there, money's coming off the books, etc. But also, like, they were already in the bottom half of the league in spending with all that dead money on the books. So I'd look at it as, well, we just spent $135 million and most of it was dead money. Imagine how nice it would be to spend $135 million and spend it on, like, actual guys who are healthy and going to contribute. And by the way, that's not a lot of money. That was below league average in terms of payroll. Also, Chicago is not a small market. It's not like they're doing this in, you know, Gary, Indiana, and they got to be payroll conscious. It's not as if they're moving to a AAA ballpark in Sacramento while they try to hijack city after city for public funding. Like, this is the Chicago White Sox with a billionaire owner, and they own the Bulls, and the Bulls have done stuff like this. Hey, we'll always spend over the cap because everyone does in the NBA, but never to the tax, never into the tax. Anyway, it's frustrating. The White Sox are ridiculous. And yeah, those Chris Getz quotes about basically being like, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? It feels very defeatist. What have you made of the Yoan Moncada situation? So they're going to pay him $5 million to go play somewhere else because that's the buyout and you can't pay him $25 million. But he's been at AAA for like a couple weeks now, raking. I know he's going to be activated this week, it sounds like, because they're coming up on that point. What do you make of the way that's played out with Yoan Moncada and maybe what his market might be? I have no idea what to make of a guy who has flashed that good but has rarely been healthy, and things got so sour there at the end with the White Sox.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I'm sure a lot of it comes down to what the rest of the infield market is looking like this winter, and that I can't say I've looked too closely into who the impending free agents are, but you don't have a, it doesn't seem like you have a ton of big stars. You've got Adames at shortstop, but in terms of second base or third base, which Moncada can do, now that Chapman's off the market, it's kind of Bregman. And then, so I think there's going to be a team that isn't looking to sign a big star and then is going to take a chance on this guy. It's probably a one-year deal because he's probably looking to prove that he can stay healthy and prove that he can still play. But I mean, someone who's just got so many injury problems, so much trouble with consistency, it's very difficult to know what to make of him as a player, what to make of his relationship with the team, what to think happens next. I wish I had a better answer for you.
No, I mean, that's it confirms my belief that I can't figure it out. And like, you know, you look at some of the years, you look at his 2021, and be like, yeah, I'd love to have that guy, you know, 20% above league average at the plate and, you know, not good at a lot of defensive positions, but you can place him a couple different spots. He's a weird one to figure out. That's a weird team to figure out. And the funniest, like, not funniest thing, but like the weirdest thing is going to be they're going to cut payroll. They're going to lose even more of their name guys like Moncada, and they trade away Eloy Jimenez and stuff like that. And they're probably going to win like 20 more games next year just by way of you can't lose 120 games every year.
Yeah, you're probably right. And to that point, I think the real interesting questions to me are if they trade Crochet and if they trade Robert over the offseason, because that would be a sign that they really are just, to me, pathetically cutting payroll. I guess I gave them some defense earlier saying, oh, they've got a lot of money coming off the books. The payroll's probably going to drop no matter what. But if they're trading the only good players they have left, the only reasons to make White Sox games worth watching sometimes, that's what's going to be really disappointing. But if that doesn't happen, yeah, I mean, a professional baseball team is still probably going to win more than 35 games in the season most years.
Okay, let's go from the worst team in baseball to, at least by record, the best team in baseball, the Philadelphia Phillies, who you take a close look at pretty regularly there. Top of the table right now with 90 wins. There's obviously, you know, they're four games clear of the Brewers to make sure that they have a bye. Obviously, they've got to keep an eye on, you know, we'd like home field against the Dodgers and things like that. But you got to feel pretty chill right now these last 2 weeks. What are you looking for from the Phillies these last couple weeks?
Yeah, well, I think that the Phillies put themselves in such a great position with a really strong first half that the past couple years, this team has made the playoffs because of a strong second half push, and we were stressing all through the first half. That Dombrowski really had to think about what he was going to do to make sure the team could just make the postseason at the trade deadline. This year's trade deadline, we saw a lot more. We saw more moves that were focused on the playoffs rather than getting to the playoffs. So the Phillies have, even though they've still playing pretty fantastic baseball lately, there have been some more problems that have popped up in the second half, especially if you look at the overall numbers. The ERA, the rotation ERA, is a little bit higher, but a lot of the problem there is that they don't have a number five starter right now. Taiwan Walker has been a disaster. Tyler Phillips has been a disaster filling into that role. I think they've tried Colby Allard a couple times out there, but the Phillies know they're making the playoffs. They know they're winning the NL East, so they don't really care about a number five starter because that's not going to matter in the postseason. So the one thing I want to do is caution Phillies fans against worrying about the occasional blowout loss, about the rotation ERA looking a little higher, because you look at the players on this team who are going to matter in the playoffs, and this is a great team. Not just the best record in baseball, I would say probably on paper, the best World Series contenders.
Yeah, certainly up there. When you can go Zach Wheeler, Aaron Nola, Christopher Sanchez, Ranger Suarez in a playoff rotation, and the back four, arguably five guys in your bullpen, are guys, I don't trust anyone in the bullpen in the playoffs, but like as far as bullpens go, it's a pretty good back couple there. I don't know what you're all that worried about other than, and even like their injured list has cleaned up a little bit, right? Like Austin Hayes and Edmundo Sousa are on there, but like that's not, you know, if Bryce Harper is healthy and Kyle Schwarber is healthy and Trey Turner is healthy, you're golden here. Schwarber, by the way, set the major league record recently with 14 leadoff home runs, a new record. Do you like that style of leadoff hitter? Like not, obviously not traditional as a contact and base stealing guy, but just a huge, yeah, you're going to start some games with a strikeout, but a record 14 leadoff home runs and obviously a boatload of walks because it's Kyle Schwarber.
Well, I think the most important things about the leadoff spot are, number one, that's the guy who gets the most at bats in the lineup. And you want a guy who's hitting that many home runs being the guy who's going to get the most at bats. And then he's also going to run a high on base percentage and get on base for Turner and Harper to drive him in. And the last thing is, it's just fun. I went to see both Phillies games in Toronto a couple weeks ago, and Schwarber hits a leadoff home run both games.
It's nice to be up 1-0 immediately.
It makes it so much more fun to watch. I mean, the more disappointing Phillies teams of the really long postseason drought, I mean, it was just often so frustrating watching them get in a hole and not be able to get out of it. And the last few years, it's been so nice as a fan getting to see this team jump ahead so often.
Yeah, it's got to be nice. I mean, the Jays have had a good turnaround season from Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but the top of the order has just been a rotating. Hey, George Springer, okay, he's been rough. Try someone else. Now it's the young guys get an opportunity. It's pretty good. It's the Kyle Schwarber thing would be fun. And honestly, it does make you think about like less conventional setups in that spot. Because I do think that like even as like people have come to appreciate, you know, on base more and things like that, hey, a slap hit, you know, Juan Pierre might not be as good a leadoff guy as we thought, as a slab hitter, base stealer. I still think it feels like there's still like a league-wide preference for that kind of guy in that spot. But yeah, hopefully Schwarber ushers in more. Okay, here's a bit of a weird Phillies one for you. So you obviously are keeping an eye on the other teams in the NL East, even though they are not relevant to the National League East title. Do you have a preference of who you'd like between the Braves and Mets to make the playoffs in that final wildcard spot? They obviously, at this point, they can't both fall out.
That's a great question, and one I have thought about quite a bit. I think recency bias comes into play, and I have more animosity towards the Braves recently, so I would like the Braves to fail. But and then you also, you look at who the Phillies might have a better chance of beating if they have to face each other in a postseason series, and the Braves have that incredible starting rotation and an incredible back end of the bullpen. And it's always about, you always prioritize pitching in the postseason. So as much as I dislike the Braves and would love to see them not even make the playoffs this year for completely illogical, personal, selfish reasons, I think that the Braves are still better built to succeed in the postseason than the Mets. The Mets have been really hot lately, but that rotation that's pitching really well doesn't have nearly the pedigree of the Braves rotation. And I think that the Phillies would have a far easier time walking right over the Mets like we saw them do this past weekend if the two meet again in the playoffs.
Yeah, now the Mets are looking down a potential Francisco Lindor injury. We'll look for an update on that today. But that's anytime a back flares up, you know, nobody talks about having a bad back in the past tense. Nobody had a bad back. You have one. And it sticks with you. So we'll see how that plays out. Leo, wanted to speak to you about something you wrote about at Fangraphs recently, which is a kind of part two of something you wrote about last year. Guys who are fast and don't make use of it. And the highlight, like the key character in the piece this year was Joe Adell of the Angels, who is so fascinating to me because he's so toolsed up, right? Like he's so fast. He hits the ball so hard. He swings the bat incredibly hard. And then the results just aren't there. First of all, why did you want to start doing this series last year? And then second of all, what do you make of a guy like Joe Adell who has all the speed in the world and can't turn it into anything the way the article outlines?
That's interesting because I know that this is part two of a piece, but it really feels like it was made for a player like Joe Adell. Like you were saying, like I decided to include a few other guys when I wrote about it, but honestly, it was all to get the story out about Joe Adell this season, who is, yes, so fast and his base running numbers are so poor. I think what I wanted to write about it last year, it's a pretty simple idea. We often talk about speed. For a long time, speed was just stolen bases. And if a guy had good speed, it was because he stole a lot of bases. But the two obviously are not actually the same thing. Speed is kind of a inherent tool, and being able to steal bases is more of a skill, I guess. And so we think a lot about the difference between raw power and game power. That gets talked about a lot more, but we don't really talk about like raw speed and game speed the same way. And so I wanted to take a look at guys who you might either think would be good base runners because they're fast, or guys who you don't realize they're fast because they're not base runners, and identify some of those players. And yeah, this year, Joe Adell really stood out above every other player that I looked at in terms of being in like the top. He's not quite as elite as he was in his first few seasons when he was really one of the fastest runners in baseball, but he's still like top 15 percentile in the league in sprint speed and one of the lowest base running values according to the metric we use at Fangraphs. And I, as I did say in the article, I don't want to put all of the blame on Adele because the Angels have been, it's not just Adele. The Angels have been rough on the bases this year. They were rough on the bases last year. And then Ron Washington came in and said he was going to change that. He had a whole new approach and it's been different. It's been bad in a different way, but it's been every bit as bad, even though these aren't slow guys. The Angels have a lot of fast runners and it makes you wish that Trout was back because he'd probably be boosting the base running numbers all by himself. He was stealing again earlier this year. He's always a great base runner. But I want to be a little cautious about how much I criticize the Angels base running because right after I published the article, Angels first base coach Bo Porter followed me on Twitter. Uh-oh. I was worried I was about to get an angry DM about my... But no, absolutely. Absolutely nothing about that.
No, it's a fascinating piece and it's a fascinating idea, right? The fact that speed doesn't line up with performance on the base pass or the counter, which is like Matt Chapman stolen 15 bases this year. It's like he's not a super fast guy. Jose Ramirez is fifth in stolen bases and he's fast, but he's not like lightning fast. Like I think he's like 70th percentile sprint speed, but has 39 stolen bases. Spencer Steer steals a bunch of bases and isn't like crazy fast. And then there's the you're really fast and it does apply to the bases, but for some reason you can't apply it to the outfield type, like Asturi Ruiz for the Athletics or Chandler Simpson, who's stolen 100 bases in the Rays system. And I talked to a scouting person last week and they were like, yeah, but he can't really like play a corner outfield. I'm like, how are you that fast that you can't play a corner outfield? I'm not fast. I don't deal with these things, but it is, I don't know. It's a really interesting topic. And then there are other, yeah, it's I guess I'm not asking you a question. I'm just making a comment to you about your article, which is something I could have just done in the comment section. Sorry, Leo.
I think that part of what you're getting at and something I've been thinking about too is that maybe we also need more ways of measuring speed. Something I've touched upon in both articles is that maybe speed isn't even one skill, but there's different elements of what makes someone a good runner. There's getting good jumps and having good immediate reaction. There's having a good maximum speed. There's being able to maintain that speed over longer than a couple of seconds. And perhaps that could explain a bit of why certain guys might be great base stealers, but not have a high sprint speed, or poor outfielders, even though they can run really fast if they're just running in a straight line for 1 second. Yeah, there's different ways to measure this, and I don't think we think about it or talk about it enough.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why you write about it a bunch and write about catchers a bunch. You also wrote recently about the Rays and how much they've been stealing bases since they waved the white flag here. They have 77 stolen bases in 54 games since the All-Star break, which is, I mean, the Nationals have more, but that's it. Nobody else is even particularly close. And some of this is obviously Jose Caballero, who... The reason he has 41 stolen bases is because he's allowed to get caught stealing a bunch too. But what have you made of kind of the Rays team-wide shift to being more and more aggressive on the bases the last little while?
Yeah, well, what I thought was very interesting about it and what really made me want to write about it was that it wasn't just one or two guys. Like a lot of the teams that you see at the top of the stolen base leaderboards, it's because they have one or two guys who are stealing, like who account for like 20% of the whole team's stolen base total. Whereas the Rays, once I saw their stolen base numbers going up, it was because almost every single guy in the lineup was stealing a little bit more often. And I mean, it's a way to win on the margins. And that's what the Rays have pretty much always done and what we've always seen from them. When I started to writing about it, I was kind of expecting I would see more of a pattern of the Rays being a consistently great base running team in the past. And that's not necessarily true, but they've had a lot of problems this year. They've had a lot of trouble scoring runs the more traditional ways, the way that they did in the past couple of years. And it seems like they're just trying to find a way to make a little more action, get a few more runs across. And it was working. I mean, the Rays have been better since the trade deadline.
Yeah. And hey, you don't have Isak Paredes anymore to just pull one just inside the left field foul line. So you got to create it a different way. And this is, you know, I do wonder with when you're a team like the Rays and your budget restricted and things like that, is there a case of in the new, like with the rule changes and stuff like that, speed is an undervalued or base stealing ability, not speed as we're talking about, is an undervalued, you know, ability right now to in the kind of what you pay for offensive players, because we've been conditioned over the last couple of decades that while there's not a ton of base stealing and it's not crucially important. So I wonder how much that factors in. So I mentioned Jose Ramirez. I know you retweeted something from our pal Adam Dorowski of Baseball Reference the other day, where Jose Ramirez is having one of the only seasons of all time where he has created X number of runs with the bat in the field as a base runner defensively and with the positional adjustment. You're playing a premium position. Is that like the best way to capture this guy as having like an incredible all around season? Like I looked at that list that Adam posted out there, and it's incredible. Like the amount of different ways Jose Ramirez has found to contribute this year is ridiculous.
Yeah. And I think funnily enough, I saw that tweet and it wasn't getting very much engagement. And I'm like, this is a great tweet. This is an underrated tweet. This is underrated, just like the guys that he's talking about in there. I mean, I think as we're seeing right now in the NL MVP race, where you have your huge star with the huge gaudy numbers in a couple of categories, Shohei Ohtani versus Francisco Lindor, the more all-around contributor, and it certainly seems like Ohtani is the clear favorite, even though, I don't know, whatever version of war you want to look at is telling you that Lindor has probably been the more valuable player this season. I think overall players like Lindor and like Jose Ramirez and like Chase Utley back during his prime with the Phillies, these are guys who get underrated because they're not putting up that one big number in any particular category. And I mean, even Jose Ramirez, who is probably not going to get there, but pretty close to a 40-40 season this year, getting overshadowed by Ohtani in that 50-50 season chase. Jose Ramirez is so good at so many things, but he doesn't have huge tools. He's a guy who makes the most of the tools that he's got. Like we were saying, he's a much better base runner than you'd expect by his speed. And he's a guy who does everything pretty well, but he's not sitting at the top of a lot of leaderboards. And it's why he's probably never going to win an MVP, even though he's going to go down as one of the best players of this generation.
Yeah, he's not going to win an MVP, but he's going to finish with like 7 or 8 top 5 finishes, which is pretty incredible. And he's headed for another one here. Leo, thanks for taking the time out, man. Best of luck to your Phillies in case we don't talk to you before then.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Leo Morgenstern of Fangraphs, Just Baseball, MLB trade rumors as well. I wanted to get to a couple of texts in the text line before we wrap it up for the day. No game tonight, of course, so we don't need to set anything up, go over the probables, whatever. We will set you up for Jays Rangers properly tomorrow. We don't know who the Jays are starting just yet. A couple questions. John in Toronto, should the Jays add another starter? And if so, what type? They could really use a 1 or 2. Would reuniting with Kikuchi be ideal? I mean, reuniting with Kikuchi's on the table. I think you don't have to worry about that. Like, I don't think there's any sort of, you traded him, you can't sign him back. That is a possibility. In terms of adding a number one or a number two, like, sure, it'd be great to have an ace, but there are only like 12 or 15 of those guys around baseball. Corbin Burns is the only one of them who is a free agent, and he's going to get like $200 million. Is that the best use of your money when you've struggled so much to create offense the last couple of years? I don't know. You just have to make your team better. If you go out there and all the outfielders and third basemen say, no, thank you, we don't want to come, then yeah, go out and get an ace. You got to make the team better somehow. I don't think it's probably the top of their priority, though. I think the priority is going to be the offensive side. And then to a lesser extent, as Ben Nicholson Smith wrote about today, the bullpen. Kevin in Toronto asked that the Jays need to maintain their league leading defense next year. Doubt they bring in legit bats this offseason. So Ernie, Varsho, and Kirk have to be everyday players. I mean, we'll see. If they, like, I don't think one corner outfielder who's below average is going to sink your entire defense. If you get Anthony Santander and it helps your offense, like, again, you're trying to win baseball games. You're not trying to lead the league in defense or lead the league in offense. You're trying to win. And if the net add of Anthony Santander's 35 home runs next year or whatever outweighs the downgrade in left field defense, then that's great and that's a plus. I think what makes you comfortable is that you have multiple years of finding ways to have a really good defense. You have multiple really good defenders who are positionally versatile. I think that gives you, you know, your bench is projecting as one that's going to be pretty solid defensively as well. And then when you have Varsho in center field and Kirk at catcher, your two of your three most important defensive positions are locked in as guys who are going to be really, really good defensively, at least if you believe the catching metrics and things like that. Not answering the Jaguars part of that question jerk. Richard and Whippy asks if Moncada would be a good fit for the Jays. And another Trevor Lawrence question that I'm not touching. Is this J.D. Bunkus in the text line? This is every text from J.D. Bunkus is about how bad Trevor Lawrence is lately. Cut it out, guys. It's not very nice. I am going to Jaguars-Bills Monday Night Football next week, though, which should be a lot of fun, even though the Jags could be looking down 0-4 here. The Blue Jays, 72-78. Actually, a small chance, given the strength of schedule here, they could nudge back to 500. They'd have to go 9-3 the rest of the way. We'll see. We'll set it up tomorrow, this series with the Rangers. Hope you all have a wonderful Monday. Thank you to Kiri, Ben, Zach, and Leo for joining us. Thanks to Austin, Amit, and Jennifer behind the glass. As always, have a great Monday. Talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow.